You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 12th of May 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme, John Kerry meets Vladimir Putin in the first visit by the US Secretary of State to Russia since the Ukraine crisis began. We'll ask our guests, Mary Dejeski and Roger Boys, what was on the agenda. Also ahead, we discuss a proposed humanitarian ceasefire in Yemen and ask, will it succeed? Plus, after the return of the British Prime Minister to Downing Street, he's appointed his new cabinet.
I want everyone round this table to be absolutely clear what we are here to do and who we are here to do it for.
We ask who's sat around David Cameron's table, who are the ones to watch from beyond Britain's borders. And after all that, we'll make time to talk a little art.
It'll be fascinating to see for how long this Picasso will hold the world record for any work of art. It could be a decade, it could be longer than that. And so we really have witnessed a piece of not just art history, but cultural history tonight here at Christie's.
After a Picasso work smashes art world records at auction, we'll discuss art and value. That is all ahead here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Welcome to Midori House. We were hearing about David Cameron's table. I think my table measures up rather well. My guests around it today are Mary Dejeski from the Independent newspaper here in the UK and Roger Boys, diplomatic editor of The Times. Welcome both to the programme. Great to have you with us. Let's start the programme in Russia, where after sitting down with his counterpart Sergei Lavrov, the US Secretary of State John Kerry has been meeting with Vladimir Putin in the Black Sea resort of Sochi. It's been the highest level US visit to Russia since the Ukraine crisis began. Kerry's been testing the country's willingness to pull back its involvement there and its backing of Syria's President Bashar al-Assad. It's also hoped the talks would cover such issues as Iran nuclear talks, Yemen, Libya. But with relations between Russia and the US at something of a low, what could these talks really achieve? Mary, I'll start with you there. You reel off those subject, you know, the subject matter there, Yemen, Libya, Iran nuclear, Ukraine, Syria. It's a sort of a worryingly enormous list. Are such talks as these, I don't know, likely to be fruitful in any way?
Well, it depends, I think, how you define fruitful. But I think the fact, the very fact that they're happening at all, that John Kerry has gone to Sochi, it's in Russia, but it's not Moscow. He doesn't have to be seen as a supplement, as a supplicant going to the Kremlin. It's not exactly neutral ground. It is, after all, Putin's territory. But it is the first meeting at anything like this level between the US and Russia since the whole fracas in Ukraine blew up. And to that extent, I think it's hugely significant.
Roger, would you go along with that? I mean, interesting, that is that thing about location that Mary mentions there? I mean, is that in itself important? Do you think, it even have been a prerequisite perhaps for Kerry to meet with Putin? And it couldn't be seen almost to take place in Moscow.
Well, there's a technical aspect to that. Let's say he's flying on to Turkey. So Sochi is actually quite a logical place to go. He's going on to the NATO foreign ministers meeting. But it could be important. But I think, the whole thing is, I think, more symbolic than anything else. I think just by touching on that whole range of subjects, it's quite clear that nothing substantial is actually being negotiated in any way. Mm. And don't forget, he has been talking to Lavrov, you know, I suppose every 2 weeks or something like that. You know, they're talking together all the time about Iran. You know, there've been meetings in United Nations forums. I mean, they talk a lot, Lavrov and Kerry. But it was this point of going to Russia, and it was, I suppose, an acknowledgement that America and the West still need Russia to achieve some things. And this was enough, of course, to please Russia a lot. I mean, Moscow is extremely excited by this visit, although it was actually quite a short visit. But my instinct is that it's less about Ukraine and more about Syria, because something seems to be changing in Syria. Kerry, after he's been to Turkey, will go to Camp David, where the Gulf monarchs are meeting with Obama, and they're very concerned about Syria too. I think that something might be moving somewhere, and he wants to get an idea of whether Russia has got some wiggle room on Assad, withdrawing somewhat, perhaps, their support for him.
Oh, maybe we'll touch upon Syria in a moment. But Mary, just on this idea of, you know, the leaders travelling to Russia to visit. I mean, we saw Merkel went to the V-Day celebrations, and most Western leaders, it should be said, did not respond to the invitation from Vladimir Putin. How important do you think that is? Because Putin seemed to sort of suggest after the Merkel meeting that, you know, the peace process was on track. And it was almost sort of reflecting on the fact that she had been there. Is it that important to physically be there, to go there, do you think?
I think it is important, and I think it was important, the symbolism on both sides over the Victory Day commemorations and Merkel's visit, not going to the parade, but going to a wreath-laying ceremony the day after, but in Moscow and at the same memorial. I think she played that rather well. I think that was a good compromise, because it recognised Russia's dead and the great role that Russia had played in the Second World War. So I think that was hugely important. I think it's also interesting, another small point maybe, but significant, that Kerry's visit, of course, is timed for after Victory Day. That is a sort of point beyond which he couldn't be seen to go, either on the day or necessarily on the day after, but now we're opening a new chapter. And, you know, it may be convenient all the pieces fit together, but I think that there is significance in that we're now looking at a post-Victory Day chapter where maybe Russia is agreeable to talking in a way that maybe it wasn't before. And I slightly disagree with Roger that about the extent to which Ukraine will be on the agenda. I think the official, as it were, announcement of this meeting suggested that there were two items on the agenda, that they were talking about current conflicts, and one was Syria and one was Ukraine. And you can imagine the sort of bargaining that went on to that announcement, that Russia didn't want it to be looked as though it was going to be exclusively about Ukraine. And it wanted somewhere where it was playing a rather different role. And Syria, of course, fits that, which is not to say that there isn't evidence or signs all over the place that something is moving in Syria at the moment.
Well, let's pick back up on that point exactly then, Roger. We know that Russia sort of, you know, broadly supports the Assad regime. They've been sponsoring this kind of notion of a political transition within the country. If there are to be changes, even if they're modest, what might they look like, do you think?
In Syria? Well, there are already things moving. There's something happening with the intelligence chiefs in Syria, for example. One of them has been accused of launching a coup, but that's within the court, which is very difficult, within the Assad court in Damascus, which, of course, is very difficult to read. But outside, you're getting a situation where Turkey and Saudi Arabia are now beginning to cooperate quite intensively, even though they have diametrically opposed views on things like the Muslim Brotherhood, for example. But they seem, in the absence of America, in the absence of American leadership, really, on many Middle Eastern issues, they seem, and with Saudi Arabia with a new team in charge, seem to be going their own way, really. They're basically working out ways in which they can operate. And it's always been clear that both Turkey and Syria always thought that toppling Assad was one of the main priorities. And America, of course, thinks that getting rid of Islamic State is the main priority, and therefore Assad should sort of stay in place until that's done. So we're getting all sorts of divisions here, which are quite interesting, and Saudi Arabia becoming very assertive. Turkey, just before an election, is also naturally assertive. So I don't know. There's something in the mix. it seems that we might get some kind of safe havens, perhaps, again in Turkey. Turkey always wanted it. America always opposed to it. Saudi Arabia now saying, well, we could maybe put some aircraft at your disposal. So there's a lot of that kind of stuff going on.
Mary, do you sort of go along with that broadly? I mean, it's hard to deal in specifics, clearly, but as a sort of a summary, that sounds about right to your way of looking
at things. No, I think that's true, with the single addition maybe, that I think the extent to which Russia has not actually been supporting Assad so much as keeping international channels open for the eventuality that there might be major changes in the future. And one of the really interesting things through the whole of the deep freeze in East-West relations over Ukraine, relations between East and West on things like Iran and Syria and the Allied withdrawal from Afghanistan, the channels have remained open and the cooperation has remained almost undiminished.
Well, let's just sort of loop back and talk a little bit more about Russia and Ukraine. A report called Putin War has been published by the Open Russia news site, which features data gathered by the opposition politician Boris Nemtsov, who was murdered back in February, claiming Moscow spent over $1 billion supplying rebels in the east of Ukraine. Also suggests that at least 220 Russian soldiers have died in fighting there. And Mary, I wonder, do we know how reports like this or others are received in Russia, if indeed they get the opportunity to see the light of day at all?
Well, they do get the opportunity to see the light of day because Russians, a lot of Russians, have access to the internet. There's a flourishing internet culture there. There's a big blogosphere and there is no censorship. It's not like China. The blogosphere in Russia is open. So that material will be available to people who want to see it. The problem, of course, is that the number of people who would be even remotely interested in it is probably very small. And the number of people who will actually believe what they see, instead of looking at it as it were, almost a propaganda volley from beyond the grave, I think that, in a way, is the biggest danger. I think also, I mean, there was a theory before Boris Nemtsov was killed that this particular dossier was one of the reasons why there were people who wanted him eliminated and off the scene. And I never really accepted that theory. I think there were all sorts of other reasons why Nemtsov might have been assassinated. But the extent to which there is opposition to Russia's involvement in eastern Ukraine is that there is a question over that, and there is also a question about the veracity and the reliability of the information as far as Russia's involvement is concerned. And I don't say that from a sort of hugely propagandistic point of view, but I think the number of absolutely reliable reports about the extent of Russia's involvement is very, very small.
Roger, let me ask you about that, because, you know, the report makes these claims. They're quite specific. Russia, of course, denies having sent regular troops. And Mary really touches upon one of the fundamental problems here, which is the acquiring of accurate information. I mean, how much does that present a problem, I guess, to both sides of the discussion when it's all so obscured by the difficulty in gathering this sort of information?
Well, I think it was quite well researched, the report, as some of Nemtsov's previous reports have been, for example, about the Sochi Olympics. There's a bit of hearsay in, there's a bit of vagueness in details, but I think it's quite a good, solid document. But as Mary says, if we think it's going to affect Russian public opinion, then of course we're quite wrong. But I think its value is because the renewal of sanctions is coming up. The first major round of EU sanctions came after the shooting down of the Malaysian airliner last July. Well, that has to be renewed, and the discussions are already beginning within the European Union about that. And it's important if you want to keep a sanctions regime alive, at least until December, when the Minsk agreement is supposed to be complete, then you have to convince those countries who are looking for an excuse to withdraw from sanctions against Russia. And one of the Russian propaganda tactics has been to actually blur the truth about the shooting down of that airliner. And the report is very precise about it, and it's actually, it uses photographic material, and it uses, and it's a very clever bit of investigative of reporting, and should be able to convince those doubters within the European Union who say, well, we don't really know who shot down this airliner. It could have been anybody. You know, it could have been a Ukrainian fighter shooting it by mistake. Or, you know, there's all these kind of counter-narratives that were introduced by the Russians after it was downed, the plane. Well, these various stories have been shot down, so to speak, in this report. And that will help. That will help this is why I'm a little bit skeptical that there will be any change on Ukrainian policy, by the way, with Kerry, because I think everything now has to play out at least to the end of the year, more or less as it's been set up. That's to say, sanctions have to be renewed. There has to be pressure on Russia, but also on Ukraine, to withdraw heavy weaponry and make sure that those basic precepts of the peace accord are implemented. And you can't really change any of the building blocks until that happens or doesn't happen in December. And therefore, that's why I'm thinking that actually that trip of Kerry's, it's just purely symbolic, really. It's just a pure, vaguely a goodwill gesture, but no more than that. It's certainly, there'll be no movement on Ukraine as a result of it.
Let's move on here on Midori House on Monocle 24 to Yemen, where Saudi-led forces earlier struck the capital, Sana'a, just hours before a planned five-day truce was hoped to commence. Backed by Washington, the Saudi-led coalition's been striking Houthi rebels and allied army units since March, aiming to restore the exiled president. The planned ceasefire is set to start tonight to let humanitarian assistance get through, but what chance of it holding, beginning? Mary, we'll start with you. It's a gloomy opening gambit, but does this ceasefire have any hope when it can barely get started?
Well, the Saudi raid earlier today, I mean, it doesn't bode well. On the other hand, you could say, well, you know, this is actually what precedes a lot of ceasefires, which is that people want to get their strikes in before the ceasefire starts. So it's not necessarily such a pessimistic omen. I think it's the actual practicalities on the ground of ensuring a ceasefire and guaranteeing it that's the most uncertain element. And I think there's been some discussion about whether, you know, if its aim is less to be a ceasefire per se as a prelude to serious talking, whether its prime purpose is humanitarian, just to have a temporary ceasefire so that the dead and injured can sort of be given decent burial, given medical treatment, that refugees can be evacuated. And there is a view that such ceasefires are really not much use. I mean, I would disagree with that. I think that if fire can be stopped for, say, even 24 or 48 hours, and we saw something like that happen in Syria a couple of years ago, then there are people who are rescued. There are people who benefit from that sort of ceasefire, even if it's so small and so short. So I don't think we should just dismiss it as unimportant, because if it does hold, even for a small space, some people will benefit.
And it provides that opportunity. Roger, it's a hugely complex conflict. We've discussed before, there's also this notion of, you know, proxy conflict being played out within Yemen's borders. When you assess the various actors involved, do you see, you know, some parties who are more willing to countenance, whether it's a ceasefire or a potential political solution, or others who are, you know, more reluctant? Are there parties who display a degree, a range of willingness to get involved, whether it's in the conflict or whether it's in the solution?
Well, I mean, I think the ceasefire is almost entirely tactical, and it's made and will be probably it'll stay intact for as long as the Gulf leaders are in Camp David with Obama, because the main source of pressure on Saudi Arabia to stop bombardment, for example, came from Obama himself. And now there they all are, except for King Salman, of course, who didn't actually go. I don't know quite what he's doing, but he didn't go to Camp David. But they're all there in their log cabins, or they will be from tomorrow and Thursday, and it would be extremely embarrassing to fly raids or to allow any other kind of bombardment. But I think once that's done, and depending on what emerges from this Camp David meeting, then it will continue, because Saudi Arabia in particular, but all the Emiratis and so on, who are part of this very amazingly quickly organized coalition that they put together, they all want to show, they're all in the pre-game before a deal is reached between America and Iran at the end of June. So they want to show that they are willing, they have the political will and the ability to show Iran its limits as a regional military adventurer, and therefore there's not the slightest motivation to stop, and there's not the slightest motivation, I must say, to find a political solution. Could be that Obama still has enough influence to try and achieve that. But I don't think so, because everything that we've seen so far suggests that actually his influence in the Middle East is completely on the wane. So my bet is you'll have 2 or 3 days of a ceasefire, and then it'll all start again, and it will continue for as long as Saudi Arabia wants to make a point. That's to say that Iran won't have all its own way when America eventually and the West eventually agree to this. These curbs on nuclear enrichment.
The insights there of Roger Boys. Mary Jeske's with us as well. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. Up next, after a short break, we'll look at the ones to watch, albeit maybe from behind the sofa, in the new UK cabinet. Stay with us.
Monocle's unrivaled network of editors and correspondents around the world bring you a brilliant new collection of books, the Monocle Travel Guides. Speaking in an informed but informal way about everything from architecture to art, late night bars to early morning markets, the Monocle Travel Guides mix the classic with the contemporary, going beyond the conventional and revealing the hidden spots that cities have to offer. Published by Gestalten, these travel guides are for people who want to get the most out of their stay, however short, and feel like locals rather than tourists in the world's great cities. These series kicks off with London and New York, available now in Monocle shops, at monocle.com, and in all good bookstores. And watch out for Hong Kong and Tokyo on the way soon. The Monocle Travel Guides. Cities are fun. Let's explore.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are Mary Djeski from The Independent here in the UK and Roger Boys from The Times of London. Next, we're going to, stay here in the UK. Prime Minister David Cameron has held his first cabinet meeting since his shock election victory, in which the Conservative Party won a majority. Amongst the names at Cameron's table are Michael Gove, the former chief whip, who in his new role as Justice Secretary may scrap the Human Rights Act, and John Whittingdale, who as the new Culture Secretary will shape the future of public service broadcasting here in the UK. So what impact will Cameron's team have on politics in the UK and beyond, perhaps crucially, in the next 5 years? And who are the ones to watch? Mary, I guess, I don't know, you look at the cabinet, some faces we know rather well, some perhaps less so. And there is, of course, that European issue swirling around, looking at 2017 and so on. Who do you think could be the definitive characters, perhaps alongside Cameron, over the next sort of 5 years or so?
It's very difficult to tell, because the immediate message from the appointment of the new cabinet is how much continuity there's been. There have been very, very few changes. The top four jobs, as they're seen, have stayed with the same incumbents, the same on social policy. Michael Gove moving to become Justice Secretary is one of the very few high-level changes. And of course, the plan to have a British Bill of Rights, as opposed to signing up to the Human Rights Act, That is potentially creates tensions with Europe, but of course it could precipitate an enormous fight in the UK. It could precipitate it not just in party political terms in the House of Commons, but people are already gearing up before anything has even been announced. They're already gearing up in the House of Lords, where there are a lot of retired judges, where there are many more Liberal Democrats and Labour members peers than the representation in the Commons. So the battle is already squaring up for that. But I think the other thing to look at abroad is, of course, Europe. And I think for, as it were, for foreign audiences, it may be hard to see really how much of an internal, how much of a domestic issue this is seen as in the UK. It's not really seen as foreign policy. And so what we're looking at is we're looking at George Osborne, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, who is also the lead negotiator with Europe on the changes that Cameron says he wants to obtain before taking everything to a referendum, what he calls the famous in-out referendum in a year or two's time.
Roger, do you go along with that? Is there a sort of almost paradoxical question about Europe that, as Mary says, the substance of the discussion is almost viewed more as a domestic question here within the UK, although it won't perhaps seem that way from colleagues in Brussels and in other European capitals?
Yes, I think so. I mean, you've got to remember this is still basically a public school, British public school cabinet, and they think in terms of cricket teams. And he's basically put a side together that is going to go into bat against the European Commission now. So there's a batting order. Yeah. So the Home Secretary, who stayed in place, but will now launch a battle on all sorts of things, starting probably with, I mean, yes, she has already started on European migrants and the whole freedom of movement. The whole thing, of course, as Mary says, is going to be coordinated by George Osborne, who has placed a lot of people who've been associated with him throughout his career in different pivotal places. For example, Amber Rudd, the new energy secretary. Former wife, you probably don't know this, but former wife of A.A. Gill. Did you know that?
Now I do.
Yeah, okay. Let's bring it back to the London Village, shall we?
There's so many pearls of wisdom here.
She's an investment banker and was on George Osborne's staff. And there's lots of people like that. And basically, it's Team Osborne. Yeah? And Team Osborne has to fight for maximum amount of concessions from the European Commission and from the rest of European Union. It has, in foreign policy terms, to build coalitions throughout Europe. Whether it can be able to do that, I'm not quite sure. But either way, it's got to get a result, because the referendum might be as soon as the end of 2016 rather than in 2017. Mm. And then after 2016, and this is really this, so there's one significance, which is to fight Europe. So you know, Michael Gove at Justice will chip in with the European Convention on Human Rights. You know, everyone will have some European cause, because that's the only way you're going to get in the newspapers, probably, apart from anything else. But that's what they're all commissioned to. So that's the first mission. And the second mission is to be Osborne's future team in the second part of these next few years, because after the referendum, basically, David Cameron checks out. Yeah, I mean, that's to say we have a fixed-term parliament, and his basic historic mission is to keep us in Europe. Pretending that it's on his terms.
Yeah. I mean, he is on the record as saying that he is not going to serve a third term.
Yes.
So many people were quite surprised that he's even got a second term. But having got a second term, then the question arises, at which point is he going to bow out?
Yes.
And will it be the end of the second term? So obviously after Europe, then everybody, as Roger says, is squaring up for the leadership of not just of the Conservative Party, but potentially for the next next government.
And that's how you've got to read this present cabinet lineup, because there are so many Osbornists in there.
Absolutely. There's some big questions to answer. Almost at the end of the show, in a second or two, we did want to mention this extraordinary price, $160 million recorded for a Picasso work. I have it here. This is denied our listeners. In a word or two, Mary, is that a good purchase? Yes, a yes or no answer, I'm afraid it needs
I think
to be.
It's absolutely gorgeous. And if I had $160 million, well, I might have found other uses for it, but I don't think it's a waste of money.
That's the view of Mary Jeske. Roger, yes or no? You go along with that?
Oh, yes. It's a beautiful picture and worth every penny. And frankly, if you're a pensioner with an annuity, go for it.
There you go. That's Roger Boys and Mary Jeske on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Thanks to our producer, Alice Block, and Toby Hammond in the studio manager's chair.